Thanks.
God, our eternal Heavenly Father, we come into Thy presence, Lord, so thankful that we can gather and consider a portion of Thy Word, seeking Thy Spirit, dear Father, and understanding from Thee as we consider the message of our prophet Ezekiel. Lord, we thank Thee for the providences that have brought us here. We ask Your blessing upon our fellowship, and may we encourage one another in this walk, and may we indeed be faithful watchmen as Ezekiel was. Bless the words to be spoken here. May they be full of honor to Thy name and pleasing to Thee and helpful to each one. We ask this all through Christ's name. Amen.
Any announcements from anybody before we start? Thank you. Sandy.
Love from your brethren in Huntsville.
Thank you.
Love from the Collinsville brethren, and especially Sister Helen Johnson.
Any report on her?
Doing very well.
Good. Brother Rick.
Sister Ruth and the Friends in Oakland County sending love and greetings to the Friends here and praying for the blessings to flow in Ezekiel.
Thank you.
Love from the Muhammad Friends, from Sister Isabel, and I talked to the Grays, the Rossins, and Brother Stephen, Sister Rosalie Palmgren, all wanted to remember. I think Brother Laddie Stewart also, and they wanted to get copies of recordings. So
there may be nothing worthy of passing on. Mark.
I got a package in the mail from Brother Laddie, and I opened it up, and there was no letter. But there were two blank CDs, and he had written Ezekiel study on the CDs. So I think I'll put two and two together.
Okay. Martha.
My mother said to give her love to everyone.
Thank you. Carol.
Sister Vanessa Stillwell in Vermont sends her love.
Thank you. My mother sends her love also. How about if we send love back when we have the opportunity? Okay. Any other announcements? Carol?
I think at some point today as a group it would be appropriate to thank the Lord for the public meeting experience that we shared.
We will do that. Okay. This kind of started when Sarah was going to have a group of brethren sitting in her living room. So this is Sarah's living room today. I know when Sister Gloria a number of years ago decided to make a motion that we study Revelation, I was scared to death. And the Lord did bless it. But there was a lot to build on. A lot of brethren's shoulders to stand on. Now, Ezekiel isn't quite like that. And I will admit from the beginning, I know little or nothing about it. So what this weekend is kind of an exploration to see where we are, what we know, where we can go maybe. I personally have a feeling that maybe it's time to start understanding this book. I mean, if it's for the church, there ain't a whole lot left in time for it to become open. So if we give it a start, maybe the Lord will give it a push. I'm going to act kind of like a traffic cop here. And the brethren up here are going to pass ideas back and forth, but everybody in the room is welcome to add questions and answers and suggestions and everything else as we go along. There is absolutely no order of approach. This is going to be totally spontaneous. Now, I will suggest one thing. Some people, like Brother Loomis used to be, just said, well, chapter 10 says this, and chapter 3 says this, and 17 says this, and most of us are not facile with what's in what chapter. So if you say chapter 9, even though maybe most of us know what's in chapter 9, might be good to say chapter 9 where it talks about the man with the writer's inkhorn, and then go on from there. Okay. Ezekiel has in it a number of things which at the moment are curious and probably in the end will be helpful. One of them is, he's the only prophet that keeps dating his visions. There's got to be a significance to the numbers in there. Because he is very specific. He says, on the such and such year, and the such and such month, and such day, I got this vision. They don't all seem to have common starting points, which makes it a little more difficult. So maybe we'll get into that today. I think, as with Revelation, names will be important. I think it will be important to translate names. It is very clear that Ezekiel is about, in our day, a condemnation of Babylon. But it doesn't always call it Babylon. I don't even think it calls it Babylon. It refers to it as Israel. It refers to it as Jerusalem. And whether there are differences between Israel and Jerusalem, we're going to have to find out. Sometimes it may be literal. In the one place it says on the mountains of Israel, and as far as I can tell, it may mean the mountains of Israel. Nothing symbolic at all. Very clearly, we all know this. There are chapters that deal with the restoration and final experiences of natural Israel, like chapters 37 through 29, the parable of the dry bones and the two sticks, the Gog and Magog invasion and its results. Clearly deal with Israel. If you read straight through the book, which I hope many of us have done, you can be applying things to Babylon, and all of a sudden you think, this must be about Israel. And I don't think yet there's a real clear way to define where that change comes. So that's probably going to be another thing to look into. The book opens with this extremely difficult four living creatures with wheels on them. And it must be important because the book keeps referring back to it. And then the book closes, chapter 40 to the end, with Ezekiel's temple, which no doubt has something to do with, well, let's put it this way. Just as the tabernacle pictures what happens now in the gospel age to the saints, the temple apparently pictures what happens in the millennial age to the world in their relationship to God. Let's see. Brother Rick.
Throw a few things out there, like the prologue.
Start throwing.
Has anyone made a list of comparisons in their reading of Ezekiel with similarities in the book of Revelation?
That was one of my questions also. I guess, Brother Rick, there's a question in my mind, and I may be backing up further, but why did the Lord give us Ezekiel? What does he add that Daniel, Jeremiah don't give us, and what are the connections to the book of Revelation? Why does the Revelator pick up so much on things from Ezekiel, you know, and things that we're still, I think, waiting for in Revelation? So,
following up on that, when you start to list them as you read along, I think you come up with, I don't have a complete list, but I think that when we all start to think about it that way, it's amazing how many similarities we do find. For example, the four living creatures.
Yes.
I mean, right off the bat. In the book of Ezekiel, the first chapter, we're introduced to this vision of God. And in the book of Revelation, right off the bat, we're introduced to God. But just before we're introduced to God in Revelation, we're introduced to this Jesus, who gave it to John through an angel and so on. And it almost seems like we're introduced to Ezekiel. And he's our guide, in a sense, who's getting these revelations. And as you continue to develop it, even eating the book, Ezekiel had to eat a scroll, and we've got Ezekiel eating a book. We've got a scroll written inside and out. In Revelation, we've got a scroll written in and out. The end of Ezekiel ends with the temple and the water coming forth, the blessed healing, the end of Revelation, similar. So there's so much that seems similar that it seems like, others have said this isn't to me, but it seems like Ezekiel is the revelation of the Old Testament, in the Old Testament, and thereby is that a clue to as what some have suggested is that maybe Ezekiel, if there's symbolic lessons to be found, would be the end of the age and lead into the kingdom, even as Revelation, it does picture the whole gospel age, but the latter part is primarily the harvest and then leads into the kingdom.
Okay, let's since this has come up, let's start by doing, by the way, CF means compare. We're going to compare some connections, or seeming connections at least, between Ezekiel and Revelation. And I hope some of you are good note takers, because while I'm trying to hold everything together here in some sort of order, I won't be able to keep good notes. Obviously, Revelation does talk about the seventh church and therefore the harvest. My own personal current prejudice is that Ezekiel is entirely about the harvest. Before we open into what Brother Rick was saying and what Brother John obviously has thought of also, I want to do just in the first chapter a use of translating names. And this was where my initial prejudice came from, that I think Ezekiel is about the harvest period, right at the beginning. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the 4th month, in the 5th day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Kebar. One second here. Well, did somebody translate Kebar? I have it, but I can't find it. Yeah, I've got it. It means extent of time. So that might mean down at the end of the age. So Ezekiel is at the extent of time. The river at the extent of time. Now, a river is either peoples or flow of water. So we might be getting the suggestion here that whatever time this is, Ezekiel is by a flow of water at the end of, well, I'm saying end of time, extent of time is the meaning of the word. That the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. This is going to come up later too. Brother Megason thinks that Ezekiel, or Son of Man, is Brother Russell. Rick and I were talking last night. It may be the whole Harvest Church with Brother Russell. Okay, continuing. In the 5th day of the month, which was the 5th year of King Jehoiachin's captivity, I did not translate him for some reason, that the word of the Lord came expressly unto Ezekiel. Now, the meaning's a little bit uncertain, but it apparently means something like, whom God will strengthen, or God will prevail. I like whom God will strengthen. Because the church in Revelation is called John, which means the grace of Jehovah, which means Jehovah strengthens us.
Jehoiachin, you,
yes,
in your notes, Jehovah will establish.
Oh, okay.
And Jehoiachin.
Is that Chin?
Jehoiachin.
Okay. The word of the Lord came expressly unto Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi. Now, it apparently means contempt. Yes. Now, the church, of course, is regarded by the world with contempt. So this is apparently saying the flowing of waters at the extent of time unto the one that Jehovah will strengthen, who is a priest, at least in training, the son of contempt, in the land of the Chaldeans, by the river Kebar. We already did that. Okay, so that's just kind of an introduction to the concept that if we translate names, it may help us establish what's happening. Now, okay, I'm going to put this up here since we already mentioned it. Ezekiel is somewhat related to the name John, whom God will strengthen, or the grace of Jehovah. Okay, now, Rick and John have done some comparisons here, so let's start writing them down. And you can give them, or you can expand on them. Start giving them. Anybody, but we'll start with Rick and John.
Could I add one other thing?
Yes.
I think it's important in those verses is that we have a priestly perspective, that Ezekiel is a priest. He sees the corruptions in the temple early in the book, and he gets the picture of the temple completed at the end. I think that's important, that we're seeing it through the eyes of, in this case, a faithful priest.
Okay.
So one of the, I mean, this is easy, one of the comparisons is that the ending of Ezekiel and the ending of Revelation both talk about the temple and glory.
Okay. Temple, in both cases, in glory, John said. Remember in Revelation?
Which temple?
In Revelation, it doesn't necessarily call it a temple, but it says, under the throne of God, we have this river flowing out.
Yeah.
And it does refer to the temple, because God and Christ are
is the temple,
thereof.
Is the temple thereof, yes.
So are we talking about what Ezekiel sees it near the beginning of the book with all the corruption in
no,
it?
No, the end.
Okay, I'm
yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah, I'll put that here, a chapter 40. By the way, John mentioned something. I said he was in the land of the Chaldeans, and it just occurred to me, we all know that Babylon was cast off in 1878, but it's still around, it's still active. And so it's saying the church here is living, still surrounded by the Babylonian concepts and activities.
We're living in their land.
We are.
Mm-hmm. We're still under Satan's rule. He's being displaced, but we're still in that second dispensation.
Yes. Okay. Carol?
I was looking for the verse, in Revelation. It says the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony was opened in
chapter
heaven.
15.
15, okay. Yes. Okay. So there, I thought that's what you were looking for in Revelation.
No. This is at the end, both books at the end have some sort of temple scene. It says Jesus is the temple, God is the temple.
Oh, okay.
Rick.
21:22, I saw no temple therein, for Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of it. And then 22:21 doesn't say temple, but it says the water came out from the throne of God, which would, I think, it just told us in the previous chapter, God is the temple, he's going to be where his throne is, so the water comes forth, which suggests back here in Ezekiel, at the end, we have the water, the river, coming out from the south side of the porch of the temple.
Okay.
So there's a similarity of having a river in both places, and connected with the throne and the temple of God in both places.
Okay. Okay. Carol?
The word Chaldean, or Chaldea, is the birthplace of Abraham.
Yes.
Which is really interesting, because if Bucai is son of contempt, so the church is viewed as contemptible by the world, but they come or they live in the land of Abraham.
Okay. Now, more
spiritual.
More things that make connection between Ezekiel and Revelation.
Two rivers.
River. Both of these are rivers of
life.
Yes. Okay, I don't want to. This is not the river Kibar. This is the one coming out of the temple. Okay.
So I'll just throw that out there. That here again, then, the temple and the river of life in both places is showing us a picture of the peaceable kingdom with the church in glory. Thereby, and they're at the end of both the book of Ezekiel and the book of Revelation, which seems to lend support to this progressive point that while you're in the harvest or the end of the age, telling you about the completion of the church during the harvest and the fall of the false system, I'm throwing that in, but the end is the glorious result of it brings you to a peaceable kingdom in both books.
Okay. John?
Well, I was going to mention the things Brother Rick had mentioned before. The scroll written inside and out is mentioned in both books. In both cases, there's an eating of the book.
Wait a minute. Scroll inside and out.
The four living creatures.
Eat book. The four living ones.
Yeah, that they're early in Ezekiel and in Revelation 4 and 5. I would also add Revelation 18, comparing that with Ezekiel 26 and 27.
You know, the city, you got to do better numbers.
Well,
Well, the pictures, of, in the case of Ezekiel, of Tyre and the nations, the whole like merchant picture of all the traffic and commerce and so forth, and the wailing over the destruction of Tyre, also with the, you know, in Revelation, it's over Babylon. And Ezekiel 26 and 27 mention all the nations. Revelation isn't that specific. But there's tremendous similarities between those passages.
I just thought of one. I'm going to put it up because I said this is a river of life, not Kibar. But if Kibar is the outflowing of truth, do you have in Revelation someplace at the end of some sort of time that there is an outflowing of truth like a river? French Revolution. Right. Satan spews a river out of his mouth, which is truth. Yes, so we do have the Revelation 12 river, which is an outpouring of truth. And you even have, here we've got this thing from Daniel about eating the book and eating the book. That also has the angel standing over the river with his hands up. So I'm going to put this down as a number. Daniel 12, Revelation 10. Oh, I don't want Daniel. I'm sorry. Where is Ezekiel? That'll stop me. Okay, Sarah's going. You want to know?
Does anybody, I mean, they've got a whole, I don't know how many cups of tea there are there, but there's coffee, decaf, regular decaf, and iced tea.
You wanted to bring refills on any of those?
Looks like everybody's doing pretty well with what we've got.
So. Okay.
Okay, I'll be back.
You're sorry you have to
Sarah,
leave.
Sarah, can you take the credit card?
She's taking
it. I took care of it, and I'll bill you.
All right, other similarities between...
Well, in Revelation 19, it talks about the fowls of the air that come together and eat the flesh of the kings and captains, and that's a quote from Ezekiel 39.
Absolutely.
It has to do with the destruction of Babylon in Revelation, but... I don't know if you want the exact passages.
Not right now.
Okay.
Yeah, we can find those and write them up later.
The judgment and wrath of God is poured out in both books.
That's true. Of course, that's hardly exclusive to those two. But
no.
okay. Oh, we'll do it. God's wrath.
You got whoredoms in both books.
Yes, you do. Write it as fornication. Okay. Carol?
You have special servant in both books. In Ezekiel, it's a watchman.
This is true. You've got that seventh angel, one of the angels that has the seven last plagues, as well as you've got Son of Man in... Okay. Seems to be same reference. Son of Man in Ezekiel... as opposed to
seventh angel.
Seventh angel in Revelation. Okay. Any others? John.
The coals spread over the city and the plagues.
Okay. Coals over the city seems quite likely to be same as the plagues poured out over Babylon. Yes.
This may be a little... I guess one of my questions about Ezekiel, because we're living later in the time of the parousia, is the question of watching. You know, what are we watching for? You know, the Lord's people were told to watch for the Lord's return. There are other things that they're mentioned to watch for, but I think watching is a theme in both books.
Give me one in Revelation.
Well, in Revelation, there's the... In the middle of the plagues, there's watch and keep your garments, for example. But I'm also thinking of, to all seven of the churches, you have him that hath an ear, let him hear, and there are admonitions in the context about watching. But there's an emphasis on the Lord's people being alert for what's coming. And in Ezekiel, you have at least two chapters where there's elaboration on what a watchman is supposed to be.
Okay. Well, let's put that down. Watch. Carol.
Well, in both of them, you have mention of Israel. It's much more plainly stated in Ezekiel about natural Israel, but then you have a focus more on spiritual Israel. But the point is, Jerusalem and Zion are mentioned in both Ezekiel and Revelation.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are there things common to one, not common to another? And I was going to suggest Israel, because Revelation is remarkably quiet on Israel. There's a couple little touches, but not much.
Natural Israel.
Yeah.
It's like Ezekiel is natural primarily, and Revelation is primarily spiritual.
Yeah.
That's how I read it.
Rick?
Well, I appreciate that, because Revelation is a history of the gospel age leading into the peaceable kingdom. So it's the story of the church, and it tells us that right from the get-go. Whereas Ezekiel was written as a message, literally, from Ezekiel to the captives in Assyria-controlled Babylon. I said that backwards. Babylonian-controlled Assyria. But there's the spiritual lessons that we can find parallels or symbolic lessons for. And I think there's a more of an emphasis on natural Israel with the peaceable kingdom, because God is showing that even though his harsh judgment that literally took place in Ezekiel's day and the destruction did not mean that he'd cast off his namesake people forever, and then shows to Ezekiel at the end that he will bring them back into the bonds of the covenant and bless them. Whereas in Revelation, because there was no, it was not emphasizing the literal destruction of Israel, but showing us the gospel age, it doesn't have to emphasize Israel restored. It just emphasizes all things are restored in the peaceable kingdom. So it just seems like...
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of Paul said he's the apostle to the
Gentiles.
As opposed to the others who are apostles to the Jews. And he kind of wonder if Ezekiel isn't, like Rick said, about the church. Revelation isn't primarily about the church, whereas Ezekiel, well, it has to do with the casting off of Babylon, is not primarily about the church, it's primarily about natural Israel and its relationship to the casting off of Babylon. Something that Karen said suggests that strongly, because in both cases you've got birds feeding on the old order. One is in Revelation 19, the other is in Ezekiel 38 or 9, I don't remember.
Nine.
But they're not the same thing, even though the same words are used. The one in Ezekiel, the birds are eating up what's left of the invaders of Israel. Whereas in Revelation, the birds are eating up Christianity. No, the invaders of Israel may be Christianity. Mm-hmm. But the point is, the focus is so different. In Revelation, the birds are eating up the enemies of the true church. It's like they're eating up the tares. But in Ezekiel, they're eating up the enemies of Israel. Which may be the clue that says Ezekiel is about the way the Lord is delivering Israel from the Gentiles. Whereas Revelation is about how the Lord's delivering the church from the apostates. That may be a clue in the long run. Remember, this is an exploratory weekend. The world calls it a think tank. So that's just a think.
Another comparison is it's the only places in the Bible where the phrase Gog and Magog are used. Both
interesting.
In Ezekiel and in Revelation.
Great. Gog and Magog are only used in those two books. That's significant. Yes. But there again, they're not used at the same time or with the same meaning. Because the Gog and Magog of Ezekiel is at the end of the Gospel Age. The Gog and Magog of Revelation is the end of the Millennial Age. So this may be an important clue. Brother Dwayne.
That just struck a chord. What about judgment in both? Ezekiel, the judgment against Gog and
now I say I can hear.
Judgment against Gog and Ezekiel and judgment against the systems in Revelation. Now, it's two different purposes, but the process would be one of judgment.
Yes.
Didn't know where that would be a
yes.
useful similarity or not.
In each case, wiping out God's enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Rick.
Might be a little interpretive in Ezekiel, but I would suggest you got Satan destroyed in both books.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. In Ezekiel, it is. Everybody knows it's in Revelation 20. But in Ezekiel, it
28.
Is 28.
And but it's the king of Tyre.
Yes.
As opposed to the prince, but the king of Tyre ends up being destroyed in 28:18, after some description of him. Thou hast defiled thy sanctuaries by the multitude of thy iniquities, by the iniquity of thy traffic. Therefore I will bring forth a fire from the midst of thee. I like that because you got the fire destroying the enemies of Satan and of God in Revelation 20. I'll bring thee to ashes upon the earth in the sight of all them that behold thee. All they shall know thee among the people shall be astonished at thee. Thou shalt be a terror and never shall be any more.
Okay, so far what we've done is make just a top-of-the-head comparison of Ezekiel and Revelation containing all of these similarities, but we know instinctively and in our guts that even though there's those similarities, they're very, very different. So the Gog and Magog, different times, different groups. Ezekiel focusing heavily on natural Israel, whereas Revelation focuses heavily on spiritual Israel. Okay, we're probably going to go to another topic here soon. Rick.
I'm just going to say that in the temple picture of Ezekiel, you have priests. And, of course, in Revelation, you've got the priest in the Christ and doing a priestly work.
Yes.
Empowered. So I'm going to suggest, that's not original with me, but I'm going to suggest that there's no other book in the Old Testament that would have this many similarities to the book of Revelation.
Now, I bet somebody would say, what about
Jeremiah?
Daniel. I mean, almost all the commentators, Isaac Newton included, write on Daniel in the Revelation. And obviously there are connections.
Well, but they both have reference to the 1,000 years.
With yes.
The river with the 1,000 measurement in Ezekiel, the 40, and then, you know, Revelation 20.
Okay. We don't have that up here. Where's the 1,000 years in Ezekiel?
Well, is it that they measure out 1,000? I think it's Ezekiel 40.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
Okay.
In Ezekiel 40, verse 44. Can I read that?
Please.
And the man said unto me, Son of man, behold, with thy eyes and heart, with no, that's not it. 43, I'm sorry. And he brought me thither, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of brass, with the line of flax in his hand, and a measuring reed, and he stood in the gate.
Boy, that sounds like Revelation what?
That's what I was just going to say. It's the same question in Revelation 1. One and 14, 15, 16. Is this the same? What what's being given to Ezekiel, what's being given to John, the person telling them is it the same person?
I wasn't thinking of chapter 1 when you were saying that. I was thinking of chapter 11, because in 11, the man is given a reed to measure the city. And, of course, you've got one in Ezekiel measuring the temple, which is the new city. I don't have that on this list, but if somebody's keeping notes, put measuring measuring by a reed. Carol?
And in Revelation 2, it's a rod.
A rod?
You know, because it's an iron rod. He rules the nations.
Oh, yeah, but we're speaking of measuring in particular.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Carol?
I don't want to split a hair here, but something Karen said about Gog and Magog only occur in Ezekiel and Revelation.
Yeah.
And when I left all my name notes at home, but it's true that Gog only occurs in Ezekiel 38 and Revelation 20. But what's interesting is going back to Genesis 10, the descendants of Noah, it doesn't say Gog, but it says in Ezekiel he's a prince of Meshach and Tubal. And Genesis 2 says, 10:2, the sons of Japheth. So we know who's going against Israel. They're Europeans. The sons of Japheth were Gomer and Magog and Madai and Javan and Tubal and Meshach and Tyrus. So I thought that was really an interesting connection back to Genesis, that they're coming from the same line of descendants against Maybe I'm off in another
world. Sorry, Sarah isn't here. She's done a big genealogy on all those families of the earth.
I know.
Well, it may come up yet in something else. Okay, look, this first thing we've done is really a top-of-the-head comparison. In my mind, it's already drawn some things I'd never realized before, and that's the focus of Revelation versus the focus of Ezekiel. Is there any more on this? If not, I'm going to erase it, and we're going to see what comes up next.
Can we reserve the right to add more later?
We can. There are no rules here this weekend.
I was glancing through Ezekiel 40, and I'm not picking out the 1,000 years there.
It's 47.
Chapter 47?
Yeah.
What verse?
It's like 3 through 5, but I had some questions on that, though. Would that be the referring, because it's actually 4 different measurements, and yet we say it refers to 1,000 years. I just wonder if that's really exactly, if it does really refer to 1,000.
Let's find out what Karen's talking about. Let's go to chapter 47. Karen, would you read? Tell us where you're reading and then read.
Can you start in 1?
Start in 1.
Okay, like 1 through 5.
Okay.
And afterwards he brought me again into the door of the house, and behold, waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward. For the forefront of the house stood towards the east, and the waters came down from under the right side of the house at the south side of the altar. Then brought he me out of the way of the gate northward, and led me about the way without unto the utter gates by the way that looks eastward. And behold, there ran out water on the right side. And when the man that had the line in his hand went forth eastward, he measured 1,000 cubits. And he brought me through the waters. The waters were to the ankles. Again he measured 1,000, and he brought me through the waters, and the waters were to the knees. And he measured 1,000 and brought me through the waters. Brought me through. The waters were to the loins. And afterwards he measured 1,000, and it was a river that I could not pass over, for the waters were risen, waters to swim in a river that could not be passed over.
Okay, and your question?
Well, there's actually 4 measurements of 1,000 there. and sometimes I've heard the brethren refer to this. This is just shows the growth of the influence of righteousness and truth in the kingdom during the 1,000 years. But there's actually four measurements of 1,000, so it's actually 4,000 long.
Yeah.
So does it really refer to the 1,000 years?
Have no idea. Rick and then Carol.
Rick, oh, I'm sorry.
No,
I
Carol
hear
and then Rick.
Said.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, when I hear that 4,000, it's like north, south, east, west. I think of the cube in of the New Jerusalem.
Oh.
That it's four square. Mm-hmm. That's what came to my mind when I was looking at that, in which the earth is contained.
Four, of course, is a symbol of
complete dominion,
universality.
Universality.
I don't know the answer yet, Rick.
Well, just an initial impression is that in the river of Eden, the river that flew out of Eden, of course, it was divided into four. In one element, that teaches us. There's a river in Ezekiel 14, when the Mount of Jesus stands when the feet of Jesus stand on the Mount of Olives and is split north and south, and there's a river that comes out. That's a river of life. And, of course, in Revelation 22, we've got the river with this river. So we can put together, I think, that in these, we're seeing that the river represents the blessings that will flow during the peaceable kingdom, which we've determined from other plain scripture is during the 1,000 year of Christ's reign, period of restitution, and that in Ezekiel, where he measures 1,000, and there's a certain depth of water going, and he measures 1,000. The repetitiveness of it, to my mind, just indicates that highway of holiness, which is another picture of the river, the highway of holiness is just showing that during this 1,000 years, there's going to be this continual progression of mankind as they walk up that highway of holiness.
Okay.
So that's how I was taking it. Why each time 1,000? I measured 1,000. I measured 1,000. It's saying during that peaceable kingdom, which is in the 1,000 years, you're going to have this progress of mankind up the highway of holiness.
Okay.
Fourthly.
All right. All right. Just we're not going to do this, but just so the concepts in our heads. Sometimes you have to compute. In other words, 1,000 cubits, if a cubit is 18 inches, or in Ezekiel, which may have a. What do they call it? The royal cubit or something like that, which is 25 inches. You're going to come up with another number entirely, which may be very significant. So we'll leave that hanging. At least we're aware that it's there. Maybe one of these days, this will all start growing into something that we'll not only be aware that it's there, but we'll be aware of what it means. But you got to know it's there first. I think one conclusion we can come to from this first segment is that you cannot interpret Ezekiel by revelation because the same things mean something different.
A good example is Babylon. Babylon in Ezekiel is not necessarily depicting nominal spiritual Christendom or spiritual in that way. Whereas in Revelation, Babylon is depicting nominal spiritual.
Well, shall we take that next? let's talk about that. Carol?
Question. Before you do that?
Yeah.
Is there a series of sevens in Ezekiel?
I'm not aware of it. Anybody aware of it?
I didn't remember it, but that doesn't mean anything. Because I was just thinking about in Revelation when it talks about the kingdom in the New Jerusalem. Seven angels, seven bowls, seven plagues, and then the sword of the wrath of God. And I just wonder, I know they're not picturing the same thing.
For the baby?
Yes.
There is there's the man with the writer's ink on, and there's six men that destroy, that have weapons.
There's seven there, yes. Okay. Are there any other sevens in Ezekiel? Okay.
Sorry, go David, on that 7.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, not to belabor it, but and maybe it doesn't mean anything in the end, but in the temple, one staircase, two staircase, three staircase, 4, 5, 6, 7.
7 stairs?
That are particularly, now there are other ways like to get up the altar, but it these are lines of approach and entry.
Uh-huh.
But
okay.
I don't know how relevant it is what we're talking about.
Well, it may be in the end.
Okay.
All right. This is tricky. I don't know how far we're going to get, but until Sarah gets back with lunch, this is what we're going to talk about. Rick said, this is not Christendom in Ezekiel. I'm going to really question him on that one. I think he may have something to it, because if you've read Ezekiel, you've seen Nebuchadnezzar, who of course was the king of Babylon, and the context simply does not fit, because it's Nebuchadnezzar that comes down against
Egypt. Israel?
And Israel. And it just doesn't fit the normal Babylon.
Tyrus?
Yes. As a matter of fact, Tyre is apparently Babylon. So if Nebuchadnezzar comes against Tyre, you got a problem. All right, so we do have Chaldea in Ezekiel. We have Israel, we have Jerusalem, we have Tyre. Any other things that might be synonyms of spiritual and or literal Israel? Martha?
Well, the Ahola.
Oh, the women. Yeah. Sisters.
In chapter 23.
Ahola and who?
Aholaba.
Ahola who?
B-A-H-O-H-O-L-I-B-A-H.
Okay. All right. Ezekiel, fortunately, or God, I guess it is, interprets it for us. He says who they represent. But it doesn't really tell us. Chapter 23.
The names are in verse 4.
Okay. And Ezekiel says they represent Israel and who?
Samaria is Ahola.
Yeah.
And Jerusalem is Aholaba. Yeah.
Samaria is Ahola. And Jerusalem is a Aholaba. Okay.
Brother David?
Yes?
I don't think Brother Jim got this handout. It might be helpful for him.
Which one?
The big one with the two extra pages.
About the 7 steps.
Has a green back.
I'll get it at break. That's okay.
Okay.
Don't worry about it.
Individual.
Thank you, though.
Yeah, it looks, because it's talking about arches.
It's just the
windows, as if to say that might be referring to your sets.
Septuagint version of
chapter 40.
Ezekiel. Okay. Any other names given to either spiritual or literal?
This probably isn't too helpful, but it's in, because we've mentioned Ahola, Samaria, and Aholaba, Jerusalem in 23. Remember in 16, we've got the two sisters, and I was just putting together and looking again, so I don't necessarily say it wrong, but we've got this, her sisters, the one is Sodom and the other's Samaria.
Yeah.
Am I looking at that right?
Yes.
I'm sorry. What chapter? What, Brother Rick? What chapter?
16.
16.
1655.
By the way, I think because of all these loose ends we're talking about, it's going to be nice to get some kind of a big picture. So the first thing we're going to try after lunch, so you can be thinking about it, is if we can actually diagram Ezekiel on the board, saying these chapters do this. These do this, and so we you get a feel of how it's glued together, because there's 40 chapters there, and that's an awful lot to deal with. But Rick brought this point up. So, Brother Rick, what makes you think, first of all, is the word Babylon used at all in Ezekiel?
Well, sometimes I think of Chaldea as Babylon in that sense.
Okay. It is used, Chaldea is definitely in there. Is the word Babylon in there? It is. Martha, give us an example.
23:15, girded with belts on their loins, with flowing turbans on it. Well, this is probably not the best verse to choose, but it says, like the Babylonians. Mm-hmm. And then the 17th verse, the Babylonians came to her to the bed of love and defiled her in her polished.
Okay.
Harlotry and...
Yeah, it says the Babylonians of Chaldea. Okay, so it does use Babylonians and Chaldeans sort of intertwined. Okay. Now, Rick's statement that stimulated this whole thing.
I'll throw out that because Nebuchadnezzar is mentioned and various things along that line, he's the king of Babylon, and historically... through the record of the Kings and Chronicles, we can track back who it was that defeated Jerusalem or took parts of Israel in partial captivities under Jehoiakim, under Jehoiachin. And we see that it was primarily the Babylonians. And so then we can, you know, feel pretty confident that, we, when we read of Ezekiel, of the destruction of the city and these captivities, that, it's Babylon that's doing this. So it seems as if the Lord is using the Babylonians favorably to punish, chastise his covenanted people, Israel, for their harlotry. So it suggests that at least in part of the book, when the judgment is against Israel for harlotry, I would suggest that Israel would picture Christendom, and the division between Israel and Jerusalem, or Israel and Judah, might suggest a division between papacy, Israel, the larger and the first ones to break off for whoredoms, and then Jerusalem, or the two tribe, Judah and Benjamin, would represent Protestantism, which came later. They had been pure, even as Judah and Jerusalem had been purer longer, more or less, because they kept the temple in Jerusalem, yet they became more responsible because they had more truth, and yet they went a-whoring themselves, which, so then we would suggest that the Babylon would then demonstrate the forces the Lord would use back then literally to punish natural Israel, and then symbolically to punish and bring down nominal spiritual Israel.
Okay, now let's try to digest that. Brother Rick's suggesting that, and I'm going to pick up his little phrase there, that at least part of Ezekiel, in other words, it's possible symbols change, in at least part of Ezekiel, Israel represents Christianity. And Babylon is the forces the Lord uses to destroy Christianity.
Well, it strikes me that, I'm not saying that's wrong, but it strikes me that the outcome is totally different. Because in Ezekiel 16, in the 50s verses, he says, you will remember your sins and be ashamed. And then I will remember your shame no more. So that has a happy ending. With Babylon, she is destroyed and not reconciled. So Israel, under the law covenant, is obviously they're translated into the new. But Israel is forgiven and reinstated, and Babylon is like Brother Rosano said, goodbye, Babylon, forever.
Okay, Carol brings up a point that I mentioned at the beginning. There is a point in the book of Ezekiel, and I don't know whether it's a specific point or not, when it obviously starts focusing on natural Israel. And that chapter 16, is a place where this kind of thing happens. And you cannot apply it to Christianity at all. It is definitely about Israel. And that's one case where what you're saying isn't going to work. Go ahead, Rick.
Well, that's because what we're saying is that in the book of Ezekiel, I'll have to give a longer answer now to help explain. So bear with me. I tried the short answer and it got misunderstood. Let me make a few candidates.
Okay.
In Ezekiel, we think a lot of it is historically accurate, and God was both prophesying through Ezekiel and recording the events of what happened with literal Babylon and literal Israel.
Okay, stop 1 second, just so we all absorb that. Brother Rick's saying there is a surface literal meaning to Ezekiel, because Ezekiel was writing to the people of natural Israel during their captivity in Babylon. And so there's a lot of just natural effect there of what actually happened. However, that doesn't particularly interest us, so go ahead.
Then I think that, as suggested, Israel represents Christendom and their final judgment for their iniquities, and Babylon represents the forces God uses to destroy Israel. So this would be a spiritual lesson that we're looking for. And yet, there is also prophecies that literally describe how God is going to restore literal Israel. Which I think in our previous discussion was pointed out, Revelation doesn't deal with that so much. So that makes Ezekiel more unique in a sense that it does deal with the restoration of literal Israel. And we suggested the possible reason is because Ezekiel also deals with the literal destruction of literal Israel back in 606. Now, that being said, that thus like Revelation isn't totally synchronized. Sometimes you have a ratcheting backwards. So too in Ezekiel, the first half of the book, 20-some-odd chapters, you might say, deals with the judgment against literal Israel and God's displeasure with their whoredoms and his judgment coming upon them. But even in that, you have, like in your chapter 16, even though he's demonstrating their whoredoms, he ends the chapter with, but I have a covenant in the future for you where you're going to be blessed. So natural Israel in the future is brought out. But then after that, you've got some more chapters that deal with God's judgment with natural Israel back in Ezekiel's day. By the time we get to Ezekiel 36, I think we have another picture of how God's going to deal with Israel in the future. Chapter 20, we've got a picture of God dealing with Israel now and in the future by coming under the rod of the covenant, chastening. But in 37, we've got this unique valley of dry bones coming together, which we're all comfortable with understanding, Israel's restored hopes during this harvest period. But then you go into 38 and 39, the final Jacob's trouble and deliverance. And in the end of 39, you've got God pouring his spirit out upon the house of Israel. So we've got the introduction of the peaceable kingdom in 39. Then in 40, we get the temple vision, which is about the peaceable kingdom. And you finish out the remaining 8 chapters all about lessons of the peaceable kingdom. So it does seem that from chapter 37, which we might start in 1878, I would think, at the earliest, all the way to the end of the book, the last 11 chapters, we would say are dealing with natural Israel and into the peaceable kingdom with restored mankind as they come under the Israelite covenant. So all this is contained in the book of Ezekiel.
I think we're going to start here. Something we're going to pick up after lunch.
Let's, because I perceive the need for our poor brains. I'm going to call this section "What We Think We're Sure Of."
Maybe.
Yes, what we think we're sure of, maybe.
Okay. Let me put this up, and then we're going to scan it together and see if we all agree or have questions regarding it. Basically, Brother Rick said, from chapter 37 to the end, big chunk of chapters, is entirely about natural Israel melding into the kingdom arrangement and explaining the arrangement of how things will work in the millennium. Okay? In other words, it's a harvest about natural Israel, who, of course, will be the earthly representatives, and then it explains the kingdom in the symbols of the divine sanctuary. Let's look and see what we've got in those chapters. And let's see if we all agree on that. Because if we all agree on that, we have virtually more than a quarter, basically a quarter of Ezekiel, we can say it does this. John.
Can I clarify? I think we're being a little to this or that. I guess the point in my mind would be, I think what I hear Brother Rick saying is that the focus from Ezekiel 37 on is on natural Israel and what Ezekiel is showing. And I got to say this first. One of the themes of Ezekiel seems to be the glory of the Lord. That's a phrase that's picked up various places, and it seems like as you get to the end, we're getting to the consummation of the Lord's glory for Israel. Now, that doesn't mean it's an exclusive picture that doesn't have references to the church and some of the features of the temple, but the focus is on Israel in Ezekiel. I think that's what Brother Rick is saying. So not that we're leaving out, you know, elements of the temple that'll refer to the church.
Yes, correct. Yes. But it's referring to the church in terms of how the kingdom works. Correct?
Sure.
Okay.
And I guess the other question I have is, I think there's a discussion we were into here, and there's a question in my mind about how far do you take a picture? Like, does Babylon equal the same thing throughout the book or not? And if so, how do you know the difference? Because I think that's part of what our discussion was. And then there's the issue of when is it both a natural and a spiritual fulfillment, and when is it only natural or when is it only spiritual?
I'm going to propose an idea, and I could be dastardly wrong. I think, let me start with something Brother Magison said, which really impressed me. He said, the Bible is for three groups and will mean something different to all three of them. He said, it is for the ones to whom it was initially written, and it meant something to them. It is for the church, and it will mean something different to them. And in the millennium, it will be for the world, and they will get something totally different out of it. I believe that. In essence, when Brother Rick then was saying some of these things just actually happened, and there they are, they're spelled out. And I agree, they actually happen. You know, Abraham had three wives. That actually happened. That's not what interests us. What interests us is that those wives were allegorical. My suggestion here, which may be heresy in the end, is that there is nothing in Ezekiel that doesn't have spiritual application later. So even though it actually happened and was true, it's got a much deeper meaning, and that's what we're looking for. Now, we may find that it's hard to pin down, but let's keep that in mind, because according to Peter, everything they wrote was for
our
admonition. Is, who cares if Abraham had 10 wives? If all it is a phone book of Abraham's relatives, that's not meaningful to us. It doesn't admonish us to anything. What admonishes us is that we found out those wives had meanings. So let's keep that in mind as we look at this. Okay, now, let's look at Ezekiel and make ourselves just a little catalog of what happens here. Because if we do, we've got a good start on mapping Israel out. What's in chapter 37? Can somebody...
The valley and the dry land.
Okay.
There's...
37 is two parables, isn't it? Dry bones, and what else? Another parable there.
Of the two sticks. Two sticks.
Two sticks. Now, we could go to interpreting details there, but that's not what we're trying for today. In your own words. Dry bones and two sticks are about who, when? Carol.
The dry bones is about the restoration of the entire nation in the millennial age. And so that they come together shows the process of them being restored part by part.
Somebody got to let somebody in there. Wished you had been here.
You see how we respected
them. You shouldn't be gone at any time during this.
Well, there's something called logistics.
Okay, dry bones. I've expanded this a little from what Carol said, but dry bones is about Israel's end of diaspora and its preparation for being the kingdom center. Okay, so we can date that from the 1870s. The two sticks, somebody do the same thing about it. What's it about?
The two tribes and the ten being reunited.
Okay. Making Israel a unit. They, like Christianity, tended to split up. God says, can't deal with you that way.
But this is interesting to me because in one hand, we think this was had an application, in a sense, in the fall of Jerusalem and the end of the 70 years when they came back, representatives from all 10 tribes, 12 tribes, came back to Israel. So on one hand, we could say there was uniting there. But here in the setting and context, it seems to demonstrate that even after the 1845 years when all Israel was cast off, the Lord is not only bringing back two and ten were lost somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm dealing with all 12 because there is no 10 lost tribes. And it's kind of like a particular scriptural evidence against the British Israelite theory that seemed to predominate during the harvest time.
Okay. Is there any one particular verse in this parable you think is most pointed?
Verse 16, moreover, thou son of man, take the one stick and write on it Judah for the children of Israel, his companions, then take the other stick and write on it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions, and join them one to another into one stick, and they shall become one in thine hand.
Okay. Rick, read 26 to 28, because he's going to bring in this thing behind Rick, this picture of the temple, and it's going to link it with the dry bones, which brings Israel out of the diaspora and prepares them to be the center of the kingdom. Go ahead, Rick.
Moreover, I will make a covenant of peace with them. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them. And I will place them and multiply them and will set my sanctuary in the midst of them forevermore.
There's the temple, pardon the interruption, but the sanctuary is going to be placed in the middle of Israel. That's why these two parables are here. He says, I've got to have a place to put it. Go ahead, Rick.
And we've got our everlasting covenant, so it's our new covenant.
Yes.
Moreover, my tabernacle also shall be with them. Yea, I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And the heathen shall know that I, the Lord, do sanctify Israel when my sanctuary shall be in the midst of them forevermore. And I can't help but say, well, we got God's tabernacle with the people here. We got the tabernacle of God with the people in Revelation 21.
We do. Okay. That's chapter 37. What's chapter 38? Let's take 38 and 9 together, simply because they're almost a unit. Carol.
It's the invasion of Gog and Magog. Jacob's trouble, basically.
Is there a point to this? Is there a point to the invasion of Israel? In other words, why does it happen? What's it supposed to do?
In Jeremiah, I think it's Jeremiah early on, God says that Israel is his witness, that he would use them as a witness of himself and his fidelity to Israel, etc. And essentially show who he is through Israel. So the point here is that God will fight for them as he did in the days of old, and he will witness that he is, because the Apostle Paul says that anyone who wants to approach God must first believe that he is, and that he is the rewarder of those who diligently seek him. So God is going to establish that he exists and that he has sanctified Israel.
Dwayne?
Actually, 38:23 and 39:28 both speak of the glory of God. It says, thus I will magnify myself in verse 23 and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am the Lord. And then in chapter 39:28, then shall they know that I am the Lord their God, which caused them to be led into captivity among the heathen, but I have gathered them unto their own land and have left none of them any more there. So I think after Jacob's trouble, I think we have the glory of the Lord is shown here very nicely.
Yes. By the way, if you've been reading through Ezekiel, it's like a refrain in a folk song. Mm-hmm. Thus shall they know that I am the Lord God. It just appears all the way through in glory places, in condemnation places. It's like the Lord saying, boy, they're going to know it. He tells his little story. Boy, they're going to know it. And it just threw the entire book. So yes, this does establish God's authority. Anything else? The point of chapters 38 and 9.
Well, 39 does end up the Spirit of God being poured out, so it does bleed into the peaceable kingdom, following on the heels of this final conflict of Jacob's trouble.
Okay. It's the threshold to the kingdom. Okay. By the way, it does other things. It destroys Babylon, apparently. Carol?
Well, I was just thinking about the refrain in Scripture, to the Jew first and also to the Gentiles. So the peaceable kingdom goes to the Jew first, and the heathen that are left round about, so then the Gentiles.
I'm going to write down, it destroys heathen polities. But I guess that's the same as establishing the peaceable kingdom. Sarah?
When I was looking at this, not from the standpoint of 38 and 39, I was amazed by the number of scriptures throughout the Old Testament where God talks about people who have been false prophets, false priests, false this and false that. So what this is doing is establishing what the truth is, and it's just the destruction of those people who said they spoke for him, and he said, I don't think so.
Yes. Yeah, that also occurs throughout Ezekiel. You say this, you say this. I didn't say that. All right. Sarah, before you came in, this little section we're doing is a beginning of trying to outline the book. And I'm calling it What We Think We Are Sure Of.
Maybe.
And we think we know, chapters 37 to the end, what they're doing, in not in detail, but in direction.
Well, in the spirit of what we think we are sure of, I'd like to throw out a question. You mentioned that Babylon apparently is destroyed here. And that was one of my questions, to why it seems to be so absent here, where it's so prevalent earlier in the book. So why the absence? I mean, is it already destroyed? Is it incidental at this point? I mean, the focus is not, at least the focus is not there.
Well, from my two cents, I think that's a point to my mind, is that Christendom is not in this final struggle of Jacob's trouble at the end. At this, the invading host does not seem to be Christendom, but rather primarily Muslims from surrounding nations coming against Israel at the end. I think Christendom has already been humbled.
Could be.
Thinking that Christendom falls before the rest of the world, because judgment begins with the house of God, I know, in one sense in 1878, but the final casting down. So I don't see any, for myself in studying Ezekiel 38, I don't see any point that I would view as depicting Christendom by name in here. But rather, in fact, the enemies seem to be depicting anarchists that come from the land of the north, and then the surrounding countries that are Muslim, not necessarily Arab.
Okay, the reason I have a little skepticism about that, the chapter 19 Revelation, destruction of Babylon, is a direct quote from Ezekiel 39, which seems to link it to the events that are occurring now. Different focus, but seems to be a link. The winepress is trodden someplace outside the city. So the destruction of Babylon seems to be outside the city, and I think it's probably in the events in Israel. The seventh plague, the Lord takes the trouble of saying that Armageddon is in the Hebrew language, trying to link the final destruction of Babylon with Israel again by specifying not only the name of the valley, Megiddo, but stressing it by the word Hebrew. So it's very possible that Babylon falls earlier than others, but it does seem to be linked to these events by scriptural references. Rick?
Along that line, the way I've envisioned it is that the great earthquake that starts in Revelation 16 as a result of the final plague being poured out, that earthquake is so great that no island and such is found anymore. It's totally consuming because it bleeds into anarchy.
Yeah.
I'm going to suggest that that's what happens here at the end of the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, it's demonstrating the totality of the anarchy, which ends, as it were, in the Lord bringing these hosts down into Israel, where he'll be magnified in their utter destruction, so that what starts with the demise of Christendom just expands around the world to have its final crescendo of the host that God brings down against Israel at the end, and then totally demolishes it.
So. Okay. Carol and then Sarah.
I have a question about that, and my point of reference is about the names, because Muslims are Hamites, and Gog and Magog, Meshach and Tubal are Japhethites.
Okay, all Muslims are not Hamites.
Okay, because some of them are Arab, right? So they would be Ishmaelites?
The Arabs are Shemites.
That's right.
But Arabs and Muslim are not synonymous.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Well, let's not get into that kind of detail.
I'm wondering in 39:21, where it talks about the heathen, and in 23, the house of Israel, it seems like there's only two groups here, as if the heathen is the broadest group versus Israel. Says, and the heathen shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity.
Where are you reading?
39:23.
Okay, go ahead.
So perhaps the fall of Babylon has already occurred, and now we're looking at the whole rest of the world, and it's the heathen are on one side and the house of Israel is on the other.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps at this point it's a larger picture than just the fall of Babylon.
Yeah.
Just a thought on the word heathen.
Yeah, we got to get rid of Babylon fairly early, because who's going to be instrumental in delivering Israel out of this?
The Christ. The church complete.
The Christ.
Ancient worthies.
Ancient worthies is what I had in mind. Uh-huh. Yeah, Christ on the other side. But you're not going to have the ancient worthies coming back with Babylon still having any kind of security.
That's probably, I'm glad this was brought out, that's probably, in my mind, the strongest link on where Babylon falls, Christendom falls, because we also have to have the great company
out,
wash the robes white, because all the blood has to be freed up from being embargoed by the Spirit begotten in order to pay it out for Adam, which will then release the ancient worthies, who will think will be on the scene at this final conflict.
Okay. Now, I'm going to just wipe our minds clear from this, because we're trying to get a big picture here. Not a detailed one yet. Okay. Now, 40, to how many chapters are there in Ezekiel?
48.
Can somebody just summarize 40 to 48 as a big something or other? Maybe we have to divide it. But.
That's simple.
Talks about Ezekiel's temple, which is...
Well, it's tremendous specifications for a temple that was never built. You know, like giving a blueprint in detail about how this is going to be, and it's not built.
Yeah. So it is a picture of what, in your mind?
Well, it's a vision of the blessings that are going to come in the peaceful kingdom we've been talking about, the instrument through which those blessings come.
I think it's the New Jerusalem.
Okay, I'm going to put that down. We may argue with it, somebody may argue with it, but the temple seems to be the New Jerusalem.
Well, I've talked with my brother Rick, and I think he thinks it's going to be built.
Yeah, we won't go into that either.
Okay.
Okay.
I was going to say, because you've got it down as the New Jerusalem, but I think he thinks there's going to be one.
Martha.
Well, this is a little note I got from a talk by Brother Burns. He said that the purpose in these chapters, 40 through 48, and talking about the temple, whether it would be literally built or not, is beside the point. He said that it embodied, the thought embodied, represents the Lord's judgments and standards by which all will be measured in the when you take all of the specifics and so forth of the temple, that it's the measuring rod or the standards by which the world of mankind will measure themselves and so forth.
Okay, I'm changing that to say that those chapters are the standards and rules for the kingdom. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's 37 through 48. That's 12 chapters, isn't it? Out of 48. That's one quarter of Ezekiel falling under what we think we are sure of.
Well, I think it's interesting from a couple standpoints in that he talks about, of course, and they witnessed, those who were there, they witnessed the destruction of the temple. And here this prophet who was contemporary with the actual event is talking about another temple. And of course we know all the prophets spoke of the times of restitution. And so they would have been very focused and interested in a temple since they saw that destroyed.
I know one thing for sure, in my mind for sure. Even if you would build a temple so that it would be a visual representation of what God's doing, they're not going to offer animal sacrifices in it, because that would be like the Mass.
Mm-hmm.
Martha.
Well, isn't that why in Revelation it says there won't be a temple there? Because that's the idea. That won't be the standard anymore, because that would be everyone's first thought.
Yeah.
Should be that. And I'm not saying that there is or isn't going to be Ezekiel's temple being built literally, but I think the idea is that it will represent something totally different than it has in the past.
Yes. Okay. We're going to break for lunch. But there we have 12, one quarter of the chapters, and we may think we know something about some of the others, and we'll come back to that. But we think we're sure of that much. You notice we're starting at the end and working toward the beginning, but that's okay. Well, with Revelation, you start with chapter 12, because we're about to explain it, and you work your way out. So, Brother Duane, would you please ask the Lord's blessing on our temporal food?
Loving Father, we do bow before Thee, grateful for the day, for the privilege of being together, of being able to search and try to determine what's truth and what's can develop from those truths. We do thank Thee for Your love, not only toward the world of mankind, toward Israel, toward us, but we thank Thee for the love of the brethren here and the desire to be together to learn more of Thy precious truth. And now as we break for our meal, help us to bless our fellowship, and we do thank Thee for the food and provisions of the brethren here and all the many labors behind the scenes. Please forgive us for our sins, and please guide and direct us according to Thy will. And we ask it in Jesus' dear name. Amen.